The play's the thing, or is it poetry on Scribble?
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. When Shay Doyle is occupied with his day job, or when he isn't occupied, he writes plays and poetry. We'll ask him how he manages that on Scribble. Almost messed that one up. You don't do this when you're on your day job. You're senior counsel at Modern Woodman.
I am, yes.
But how did you get into the playwriting business?
The playwriting business, I guess I started when I was in college. And the first play I wrote, I was doing junior year abroad in Ireland, and there's probably no better training ground for plays than Ireland. So that's where I got into the playwriting. Poetry was actually probably an offshoot of law school.
That is what amazes me. This program is 3 years old. The first April, we had four poets on for Poetry Month.
Yeah.
Three of them were lawyers. What is it with law and poetry? You would think nothing could be more opposite.
Well, yeah, you probably would think that. But law school is really an education in close reading. And that's really what poetry is all about, too. So that's how the poetry part of my art kind of came to be. Lawyers make their living with words just like poets, I suppose. So, but it's really that close reading and attention to detail that brings you into the poetry. So I guess I'm not surprised.
Well, we were.
So is it the same thing that I'm interested in how law sort of influences your poetry and then vice versa? How does poetry help you with your work in law?
Well, I don't think either one helps or hurts the other. I see it as sort of maybe similar skills, but at the same time, the end product is vastly different. And poetry is really, for me anyway, about sounds and about how it's the music of the words. And obviously, in the law, I suppose you're trying to persuade people and using language in a much different way. That's the way I view it. I'm not sure how the other.
Well, both
poets
are persuasive, though, or supposed to be,
yeah,
right?
Well, what happens with spontaneous overflow of powerful emotion? I mean,
right.
Well, a paragraph later, he's saying emotion recollected in tranquility, right?
Okay. Well,
words,
whatever.
Thinking
it is.
About that.
he's
hedging. Wordsworth is hedging his bets.
I can't do it. That's all I know. I can do
and
verses.
I can't either, and I'm frustrated by the fact that I can't.
Well, you have these aspirations. I mean, you know, I'm content with the workaday world. But Shay, obviously you have spent some time and energy with this. I count 7 plays you have written that have been produced.
Right.
Do you have any that have not been produced?
Sure, yeah. I've probably written 3 or 4 others. And I've also written some screenplays, and that's kind of a different art in and of itself. And probably 100 poems, so 17 of them have been published.
My goodness. You know, I have thought about writing plays. I've thought of a couple of plots, and I think that would work really well. I sit down to write, and I don't know how to begin.
Yeah, you just have to do it, I guess, and put pen to paper, right?
Well, what
the workaday world?
Start at the beginning. What triggers a new play? Is it a character, a phrase that you overhear, a problem that you see, or what pops into your mind first and said that would make a good play?
Yeah, sometimes it's all of those things, and I've written, as I say, maybe 10 of them, and they probably all have different origin stories. For me, probably it's more of an idea than anything else. I wrote Potsdam about the kind of the decimation of German heritage from the world wars here in the Quad Cities. And so that was sort of the idea, and then the characters came later. Some of the other ones, I was working on kind of a nursing home play, and I met a guy who actually liked being in a nursing home, and I thought that would be an amazing play to have that kind of background story on a character. So mm-hmm. sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other, sometimes it's none of those.
And what about poetry? Is it the same? Is it a phrase? You a sound? You say sound is important to you in poetry.
Sometimes it's a sound. Sometimes it's an idea. One poem that I wrote, a relative of mine refurbished an altar at a church, and he wasn't even invited to the opening. Eventually, that was rectified. But I thought that would be a good subject for a poem, and so I wrote it.
You never know. I once said something about people living on the ragged edge of possibility. A friend of mine's a poet, said, "That's a great line."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, if you can make a poem of it, do it."
So you can have it.
he took three tries at it, wrote three poems using that line.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, one line is not a poem.
No, and poems come very slowly for me. I'll probably write 27 versions of a poem before I get it right. Mm-hmm. The sounds, as I said, come first, and then to me they have to make sense. They're not just there as, you know, showing off for some kind of sonorous ability, but also there has to be something that the reader can take away.
Give us an example of one of your poems.
Sure, I'll read the one I talked about. It's called "At Work in God's Shop." A church isn't built with cardinal's hands, the ordinary block and chop of labor, a long diagram to plan, with time at the end for bones and robes. The hushed house in awe, not for the incensed men in red, but for the quiet work of hammer and saw. An ordinary hallelujah that can't help but please God and those who are in on the tricks of the trade.
Well, that was published in Lyrical Iowa?
Yes. Yeah.
I notice you have quite a few in Lyrical Iowa. As a matter of fact, I think almost all but one.
Yeah, it's the Iowa Poetry Association. They've been very kind, and I've tried to submit work to them every year that I can, and I've been fortunate. And I love that sort of local interaction. They're all Iowa poets, and they produce a volume every year. It's getting harder, I think, to get in as more people submit. I think they get about 1,500 submissions for the adult general category.
And how many get in?
I don't know what the exact number is. Maybe 200.
Boy,
it's not a very big book. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot. How about a play? I notice a New Ground Theater, an Unsafe Ensemble, and what, Well Done?
Yeah.
That's brand new.
Yeah, it was New Ground has been, I think, exemplary in trying to foster local talent, and they'll do a playwright fest every now and then, and that was accepted and then performed. So I've had good luck with them, and they're a great group. We are not short on theater groups here in the Quad Cities, and it's a real blessing, I think.
But you write a play, and then somebody else does it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you sit like a brood hen to watch this egg hatched, or what?
Yeah. I guess I've talked about Potsdam earlier, and I had a vision, and the director had a completely different vision. And she kind of pulled it apart and put it back together. And it was that part of the collaborative process of playwriting is sometimes painful, although this, she absolutely got it right, I think. And I wrote it in a very realistic setting, and she staged it very abstractly. And I thought that was brilliant on her part to understand how to convey kind of the idea of that through the abstract staging. It was
do you
great.
Have any control over?
I don't know. I mean, we're close enough here in the Quad
right.
Cities that we can talk things out. I suppose if I wrote a play and licensed it, I'd have certain other rights, but I trusted New Ground and it paid off, I think.
Well, the amount of theater in the Quad Cities is just absolutely astounding.
Yeah, it's
and
it's,
it seems to be growing.
Right. I think so. I think that's right. In fact, I think there may even be a shortage of actors, which is a
That's a problem.
Right.
You might know about that.
Yes, that's a well. Of course, I used to work with the Genesius Guild, and we train actors.
Right,
and then they go on into other theater groups.
Well, I grew up here in the Quad Cities, Don. So I suppose Genesius Guild can take a little credit for whatever little thing I produce because I went to Genesius Guild and saw, you know, it was great. When I went to college, they would have people in my English class say, well, how many of Shakespeare's plays have you seen staged? And, you know, you'd rattle off the number, and I had the last hand standing, and they said, no, I'm not talking about reading. I said, no, I've seen them. And it was quite astounding. And they said, well, where are you from?
It's even more astounding when that happens in a Greek drama class.
Exactly. Exactly.
But do you have a play in process now?
I'm always working on a few things. I don't have one that's at the point where I would share it with a theater company or anything. But as I said, I really want to get this play right about the guy who enjoyed being in a nursing home. Wheelies, another play that I wrote, I wanted to write a comedy about a guy in a wheelchair, and so I did. And that was, you know, again, kind of an idea-based play. I'm working on a screenplay right now. My great-grandmother ran off with the Tent Theater back in the teens of the previous century, and I thought that would be a great story to tell. Not too many people know about Tent Theater.
Iowa was one of the hotbeds.
It was,
of theater.
Yeah, up in Cibulo, yeah. That's the company she joined. And it was the largest form of popular entertainment at the time, making more money than movies and Broadway combined.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you have this body of work in addition to what is obviously very demanding legal work. Do you set aside a regular time to write or just whenever the spirit moves you?
Really, it's whenever the spirit moves me. I don't have a disciplined writing time, and because, you know, obviously the demands of the job vary from time to time. I might have a little bit more time one evening or one Saturday or something than another.
See, Roel, lack of discipline is good.
It's not bad. It's worked so far for me.
You're talking to Mr. Well, it's already Thursday. I'm going to start Monday.
Yeah.
Right? And Monday never starts. I want to come back to the poem you read a few minutes ago, because one of the things that really struck me is how you use rhyme in the poem, but you hide it so well that people would not even guess that it rhymed. You know, the mistake I think that a lot of would-be poets make is that they let the rhyme carry away the meaning.
Right, I agree.
So I'd like to have you read that poem over again and have our listeners see if they can even find the rhyme in it. You do that so well.
Sure. A church isn't built with cardinal's hands, the ordinary block and chop of labor, a long diagrammed plan, with time at the end for bones and robes, the hushed house in awe, not for the incensed men in red, but for the quiet work of hammer and saw. An ordinary hallelujah that can't help but please God and those who are in on the tricks of the trade.
Yeah, you use slant rhyme and internal rhyme and and end rhyme, but you do it, I mean, that really professionally.
Thank you. And the last line really is about what you were just talking about.
Right.
It's those of us who are in on the tricks of the trade. I was sort of talking about crafting a poem there, too.
Yeah. No, I like that.
Thank you.
Read another poem.
Okay. This poem's called Last Light. Cigar down to the end, twilight outside with too very little light, like the ancestors whose days were tied to the sun. One more word before night comes, a forgotten prayer to a forgotten God. Don't leave me yet. A few more lines, a few more minutes here with myself. It's a powerful defense against the blackness of night. Black ink on a white page, evidence we were here, struggling to make out the sounds, desperate for a few more minutes, please.
What moves you to write a poem?
It could be things going on in my life. I don't tend to write autobiography-type poems, but again, just a phrase sometimes, something in the news, something in my past or my – I write a lot of Irish things that seem to get published. I think maybe – I don't know why people like that so much. But after – I lived there for a year, briefly, obviously, but it's left a lasting impact. So it could be anything, really.
Yeah, there's lyricism and music and dance in Ireland.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly constant thing.
The one thing I admire about them so much is, you know, English now is their language, but it wasn't always their language. And they seem to have learned to weaponize the English language.
Well, a lot of tricks of the trade.
A lot of tricks of the trade.
Do you have a steady output, or do you go in stretches?
Stretches, really, I think. And it's been a little bit of a dry spell the past maybe 6 months, but I'm working on two poems now. Lyrical Iowa closes for submissions at the end of February, so sort of time is of the essence. So.
Yeah, you better get moving.
I know.
How many poems are you allowed to send in?
I think you can send in five, and I usually send in three or four.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's have you submitted in other places?
Or? I have just a little bit, haven't had as much luck as with the Iowa Poetry Association, but you know, I'm pleased with that. I've been kind of kicking around an idea of a little anthology, a chapbook of poems.
I wondered if you were going to collect your poems in one volume.
I think maybe now's the time. I've had enough publishing experience and a body of work. So maybe now's the time.
Does anyone ever critique your poems?
My wife, yeah.
Oh, well. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't get tougher than
No,
that.
It doesn't. It doesn't. She's very honest, and that's very good. But, we had in our playwriting group, we had a group a few years ago, and we'd kind of trade scenes back and forth, and it was thrilling. And that may be resurrecting soon. That was also with Newground Theater. And I hope it does, because there's a lot of talented people. I know you've had Jason Platt on the show, mm-hmm. and he's a great writer, and D. Canfield too. So
yeah, have you experimented with other forms of writing?
I've written a couple novels a long time ago that weren't real good, and
wow.
maybe I'll resurrect that someday too. But I've kind of found my groove with poetry and playwriting, which I mean, playwriting is really long form poetry anyway. I think so. They're similar.
Well, that's
skills.
A good Irish statement.
Yeah,
make,
do you think so?
Do you, when you start out to write a play, do you, like this one about a man who enjoys being in the nursing home, do you have some idea of how it's going to end, or does the play teach you things as
No,
you go?
The play teaches me, and a lot of times I'll figure out where the play is going all at once. That's one thing that seems to be consistent. I'll be out on a walk, and suddenly, you know, I'll see how the train comes into the station at the end. And then I'll quickly have to write that
halfway
down.
Halfway through? Or
so it depends. It really depends. You know, you may have set a play aside for a year and it doesn't kind of reveal itself, and then all of a sudden kind of figure it out.
Things look different when you let them sit for a while,
they
don't
do. They do. They do, yeah. And even the poetry, sometimes it comes very quickly, and sometimes it's years. And again, I tend to rework them quite a bit.
When you say you edit poems, go over them many times. I've always wondered about that, because sometimes when I look back at all I write are columns, and sometimes little skits that are mistaken as plays, and when I look back at them years later, I have a completely different, you know, I approach them as strangers.
Right. No, that's true.
And sometimes I'm highly critical and sometimes I'm highly pleased.
Yeah. I once was looking for a poem that I thought, I remembered writing it and I thought it was amazing. And I thought, I got to go find that. When I picked it up, I thought, man, this is really terrible stuff.
Oh, yes. My kids stumbled on letters I wrote to my wife when I was in college. And I quickly took them and burned them.
Yeah.
Because I would hate anyone to think my wife would marry such a callow fellow. Oh, my. Well, that is very interesting. And as Roel says, it is amazing the number of lawyers we found who are poets. Have you found other lawyers who are playwrights?
Yeah, there's a few.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess if you want to think about it broadly in the law, you're trying to tell a story, especially if you're, you know, a trial lawyer. That's a great skill, so you kind of create it that way. And I think all lawyers are readers almost by necessity. So you have that skill and that and that practice every day.
Well, I am impressed and pleased that you took time to talk to us today, Shay. And keep writing. Do you know when your next play goes up?
No, I don't. I wish. I wish I had something to plug here, but I don't. And thank you for inviting me today. This has been my pleasure.
Okay, it's my pleasure. Shay Doyle, poet and playwright. I hope you will now start to write plays, take some kind of activity that way.
The number of plays he's written and the number of poems he's written,
it is just amazing.
Put me more in my hole, I think, than ever. I'll never even. First of all, I have no idea how you write a play.
No.
That seems to me to be, you know, fiction squared.
Yeah, that's. That is beyond my ken, that's for sure. But what do you have in the book bag today?
I've got a book, now that the winter seems safely over, as we're recording this at least, a book called The Snow Tourist by Charlie English. Charlie English is one of the editors of The Guardian magazine in England. But he is fascinated by snow, and it becomes his hobby, such a hobby that every year for a month or so, he leaves his wife, who can't stand snow, and goes to some cold climate to study snow. It begins in Alaska, way out in the middle of nowhere, by a guide who knows how to build igloos and things like that. And he learns all about snow there, how to build an igloo and what kind of snow makes a good igloo. And then he goes to the Alps, and he has a guide lead him over avalanches, and he discovers how avalanches are formed and why they're formed. If you ever want to know anything about snow, this is the book to read. He goes to Mount Rainier and Mount Baker, both of which claim to have the largest snowfall, annual snowfall in the world, but probably don't. He starts out in New Hampshire with the man who first discovered that snow, no two snowflakes are alike, which turns out, in fact, not to be real, but why snowflakes have six sides. He took picture after picture of snowflakes, and today he's famous in snow circles, this guy. It turns out that not all snowflakes are six-sided. Some are cylindrical. Some are shaped like emeralds. He has a great chapter on snow in art, starting with the Bruegel's painting of a snowy landscape. And particularly in his section on art, talks about the way in which snow is at the same time comforting, right? A snowflake, grandma's house we go, and at the same time devastating and grim and dark and deep. And how painters like Bruegel are able to capture that in the same painting. He goes to Norway and finds out that it was a Norwegian that not only invented skis, but invented the ski slope for the jump off, because you can go further and get hurt less if you land on a slope rather than on a flat surface.
It would amaze me that anyone would ever think of going off a ski jump onto a flat surface.
Well,
that's
what they did at
first.
That's
a good way to break all their
right?
legs.
We used to do that with toboggans, and but not a huge ski stump. At any rate, if you ever wanted to know anything about snow, and even if you didn't, this book will make you want to know about snow. It is very well written, and there are some really fascinating things.
You got the science of the snowflake in there as
yep.
well?
Oh, yeah. I don't know anything about snow that probably isn't here. it is really well done.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's light reading. It's not a treatise on snow.
Title and author?
The Snow Tourist by Charlie English.
The Snow Tourist. Oh, that's an interesting concept, I must say. I have a book that has just come out by Bart D. Ehrman, who is the most prolific writer on biblical subjects that I know. He's written something like 30 books in 31 years, and I have yet to read one that isn't absolutely fascinating and easy to read.
Mr. Ehrman is starting to veer, I think, right? He graduated from Wheaton College.
Oh, and, yeah. He was a fundamentalist, and as he studied the Bible, questions began to pop right into his mind, as they certainly did mine, even in grade school. And he pursued it. He gradually no longer became a Christian, not an atheist, really, but an amazingly tolerant soul. He truly is. He doesn't write polemics, but he goes into exhausting detail. And this book is one that everyone would want to read of any persuasion, The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World. And when you think about it, nothing like this had ever happened before.
Right.
You start with about 20 illiterate men and women in Jerusalem. And the next thing you know, you have a dominant religion that shapes law, music, everything, all the disciplines in the West. The West would not be what it is without Christianity. And that's just a simple fact. There's an amazing graph it has in here on page 171. In the year 150, there were 30 to 40,000 Christians right in the world, 150. In the year 400, there were 25 to 35 million Christians. And how did that happen, that phenomenal growth? Now, of course, the devout will see in that the hand of God. But there are reasons, and he goes into painstaking detail every step of the way, the role that Constantine played in this. And he just does a fascinating—
Which it turns out he claims isn't as great as, you know, we think that was the big turning point.
No, it wasn't.
But I think, doesn't he say in that book that it would have happened anyway, with or without Constantine?
Yeah, with or without Constantine, this
would have happened. It had reached a point of no return, and—
That's right. And it just, in some countries, it was the conversion of the leader of the country, the king, and then everybody followed suit. But really, I think the most appealing thing about Christianity was that it included women and slaves.
Right, an audience that had been overlooked.
That's right. Women, slaves, and children. It's amazing. You know, we have such an interpretation of childhood today is absolutely different from the way people thought about children even 200 years ago. So it is a book that is, I find it exhilarating reading. But then I like almost everything that Bart Ehrman has come up with. Some of his stuff people will find very controversial, but I think The Triumph of Christianity will be read by every shade of Christian with deep interest, because it is a fascinating story. And as I say, he mentions that Mormonism is beginning to rise almost as rapidly.
Right.
So anyway, The Triumph of Christianity is brand new book out by Bart D. Ehrman, and you will be fascinated by it. And we hope that you'll be interested enough to join us again next week. I'm Don Wood with Roll Tweet. We'll see you on the next edition of Scribble.